Tonight on Arena, Sean Davey on the world premiere of the National Symphony Orchestra Commission, St. Patrick's Overture, and Drive Away Dolls, The New Boy, and Monster are the movies up for review. +51 551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings on the live stream, which is available on rte.ie/arena. Tonight, in our film reviews, Drive Away Dolls, the latest offering from a singular Coen brother, Ethan, to be exact. It has a starry cast, including Oscar nominee Coleman Domingo. Does it deliver on story? We will find out. In The New Boy, Cate Blanchett plays a nun caring for a wayward Aboriginal child in wartime Australia. And in Japanese drama Monster, a mother confronts a teacher about her son's disturbing behaviour, and we try to work out who the monster is in this story. Donald Clark and Arlene Hunt have been to the movies for us, and they're both with me in studio this evening. And let's start with Drive Away Dolls, directed, as I said, by Ethan Coen. No Joel this time. It tells the story of two friends whose road trip to Florida brings them more than they bargained for. I suppose, are we half as excited about this Coen brother movie as we would be if it were the two of them?
Well, I think we could, before seeing it, we could allow ourselves to be more excited than that. I mean, in that, I thought his brother's tragedy, Macbeth, was very good. Mm. I thought it was a darn good Macbeth with good performances from Denzel and Mrs. Coen, Frances McDormand. So in that sense, I think, yes, you could probably approach it with slightly more than 50% enthusiasm.
Excitement, yeah.
Now let's find out if that's satisfied, shall we?
Yeah. I'm just wondering if it is. I fear it may not be. Arlene.
Yes.
That's a loaded response to a very unloaded question. Can you tell us the plot? Is it very complicated?
No, it's not complicated at all. Jamie and Marion are stone cold lesbians. That's probably the best way to describe it. And they're unlucky in love because Jamie is a two-timing tow rag and Marion has not been with somebody for 4 years.
She deserves to be unlucky, though,
doesn't
she?
Yeah, so we don't keep a lot of sympathy for her. So because they need to get out of town just to get away from, you know, her ex-girlfriend, who's a police officer, they decide, well, actually it was Marion was going down to Tallahassee in Florida to see her aunt and go birding. That is not a euphemism. They are going to go birding.
And they miss a joke there, don't they, I think?
Annie Hoodle. Yeah. They, to keep the cost down of the journey, they go for a drive-away car, which is essentially that they go to a car dealership and they take a car and the car needs to be somewhere else. In this case, the car needs to be in Tallahassee in Florida. So they will drive the car and, you know, in doing so, they'll keep the cost down. The car will get to its destination.
Delivering, yeah.
And
everybody's happy.
Okay. So, but unfortunately, because, you know, reasons, there's a suitcase in this car, which belongs... Yeah, and there are people after this suitcase because the suitcase is incredibly valuable. And so as soon as the girls take the car, the chase becomes the chase across country.
I have to say, not having seen the movie, but having listened to just one clip, I thought, I want to hear more of Curly. Curly is the character played by Bill Camp. And he is the guy who's going to let them rent the car to deliver it down to Tallahassee. So here we have Jamie, played by Margaret Qualley, and Geraldine Viswanathan, playing the part of Marion, embarking on this road trip to Tallahassee and hiring the car from the very chatty Curly.
Can you help us? We need a drive away.
$250 deposit reference.
Reverence.
Somebody local, I can break his balls if you don't show up where you're supposed to.
His balls?
Can the reference be a woman?
We don't know a lot of men.
No kidding. Where do you want to go?
Tallahassee?
Tallahassee?
What's wrong with Tallahassee? It's very nice. There's Spanish moss and live oak.
Curly here.
Don't call me Curly.
And your name Curly?
My name is Curly. We just met. It's too familiar.
Have you ever been to Tallahassee?
No, I got good sense. Your car is a Dodge Aries.
Oh, okay. Is that a good car?
Not really.
You sell those shirts?
There we go. I'm going to call her Qualley again, Margaret Qualley, yeah. And Geraldine Viswanathan there as Jamie and Marion. Bill Camp as Curly there. I have to say, when I heard that clip, as I say, I can't make a mind up about a film I haven't seen. But that clip alone made me think, I want to see more of that kind of slow kind of play, which is very Coen Brothers, isn't it? Or is it?
It is. The fact they set this film in 1999, I think, was problematic. I mean, it ended up that way partly because Tricia Cook, who is also Ethan Coen's wife, wrote the screenplay 20 years ago and they couldn't get it made. Partly because at that stage, they have said that it was hard to get a film with this degree of explicit lesbian sex on screen. Things have opened up. We're now a bit more liberal about those things, and that helped them with that. But my point about being set in the 1990s is I could not get out of my head all those terrible, terrible rip-offs of Tarantino and Coen films that ran throughout the 1990s. Things like Very Bad Things, Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag, Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, all of which came across as ersatz, yellow pack versions of the Coen Brothers. And actually more Tarantino than Coen Brothers, right. Yes, which never felt like the real thing, which everything was half-assed, all the jokes fell flat, and everyone was trying far, far too hard, which is what is how this struck me all the way through. The dialogue for me does not function. It is full of all these moments where it is so explicitly nodding towards those films that I'm talking about, the inspirations for the films that I'm talking about, that I wonder, am I missing something? Is there some kind of like proto-joke going on here? Some meta-gag? It is, for example, we already mentioned the suitcase in the car. There is the mysterious suitcase in the car which contains something terrible. It actually turns out to be a very bad, blasé, crass gag, what's in the suitcase. But, I mean, that's Pulp Fiction, which in itself is a reference to Kiss Me Deadly. Is that deliberately a gag about the fact that that was a reference to something else in Pulp Fiction? They actually have that shot from the inside of the boot of the car when they lift the boot up and you see upwards, which comes from Pulp Fiction and other things as well.
So
and
is it
that baffles me? Is it like you're doing everything possible to get me to say
this is a
belated example of those rip-offs from the 1990s of films by you to a certain extent, and also by Tarantino?
Is that what you need to be looking for if you're watching it then, Arlene? That this is a rip-off of, this is a pastiche of one of me and my brother's movies. And will that help you through it?
No.
You're so stony-faced about
this. It won't help
this.
You through it. There's nothing will help you through this film. Nothing will help you through this film. Apart from the end of this film will help you through this film. And you might get there eventually. You don't know. It seems to go on longer than its actual running time.
It's really short.
It's a short film, and yet it feels so
very long.
It feels very long. It just doesn't work on any level. The characters don't work. They don't seem to have any connection really to each other. There's no build up of their history together.
Flat quips,
and they don't speak like normal people. Everything is either a lecture or a sideshow.
One of the things that they would say that's an advance on that era is what I mentioned earlier on, the fact you're able to have these relatively explicit same-sex scenes in the film, but they're all played for laughs, and there's nothing I think less funny than funny sex. It reminds me of nothing so much as like 1970s British sex comedies, of Confessions films, of Robin Asquith. No harm to Robin Asquith, good actor, but to that sort of stuff. That, I mean, it's as if they're embarrassed by the potential erotic power of what they're doing. So, as was the case with those buttoned-up 1970s British sex comedies, they have to play it all for laughs. Just baffling, and none of that worked either.
Yeah, so who knew that the Coen brothers had, or that certainly Joel, or Ethan, beg your pardon, had watched a lot of Carry On, possibly Benny Hill or something?
Benny Hill is what came to my mind when I saw one of the scenes. This is what I'm talking about as well, how tired this is. It's a tired film in many ways.
They think it's quite progressive.
And it's not.
Quite groundbreaking. It's nothing
so the
sort.
Benny Hill reference is to, they find along the way, along their dyke journey, which is what they call their popping off to different towns and stuff, and it's like dyke adventure. And they meet up with a soccer team, a female soccer team, who are all lesbians, all of them. And their idea of fun is to just do kissing exchanges in a basement somewhere. And it's just, it's, yeah, well, it's
given
kind
that
of,
you would have thought that they, if the sex scenes might have had a little bit more liberality, you'd think there would be a slightly more nuanced approach, perhaps.
It's just daft.
To be fair to them, and certainly to Ethan Coen, I mean, he knows it's stupid. I talked to him about this actually, and he did say that it's quite funny about that actually. He said that it was quite easy to get a lesbian film made in the early 20 years ago, but hard to get one that made it was stupid. So I think he knows it's stupid. Right. He knows it's dumb, but stupid is not necessarily equal funny.
Yeah, it doesn't. All right, but there is a great cast in here.
Good supporting cast. Yeah. Coleman Domingo, Pedro Pascal, Bill Camp, Matt Damon.
Matt Damon in there.
Damon's good, actually. I mean, unfortunately, the part is an absolute clunker. It's like, ho, 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 we have this hypocritical senator who is saying all these things, but in fact, underneath is as perverted.
No, correct.
I know, it's amazing, yeah.
But he does lift
it. Here's
the difference, right? When he comes on screen, he does lift the film slightly.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's amazing because he's not on screen that for a long period of time. And people should understand this before they go into it. Pedro Pascal is only in this film for a very short period of time. Matt Damon's only in this film for a very short period of time. So don't go thinking you're going to see these guys. You're not.
All right, it did not do it for you. Let me get stars from you first of all, Donald.
I'm going to stretch to two. I'm having second thoughts about that now.
Stretching to two with second thoughts. You will even things out for us, will you, Arlene?
Yes, I'm keeping all my stars to myself. No stars for this movie. I'm not giving it a star.
Not even a single one.
No. I don't know who Matt Damon owes money to get into this film, but I'm not doing it. I'm not giving this film any stars. Don't go see it.
Don't go see it. Not going on the poster. All right. It sounds like a bit of a disappointment all round. Let us move on then to The New Boy, Australia. An outback drama called The New Boy about an unusually gifted Aboriginal child and the nun whose care he falls into. The nun in question being Sister Eileen is played by Antipodean acting legend of stage and screen, Cate Blanchett. There's a moment at the beginning of this film, Arlene, and I thought, where are we heading into here? It's the opening caption. It talks about right through the 20th century that the Australian government's policy regarding Aboriginal children was to breed out the black.
Breed out the black. Yeah, it's a terrifying sentence.
I really thought, wow, we're in for a very harrowing ride here in terms of the story.
So did I. I had to sort of gird my loins from that opening scene. And actually, you know, the scene directly thereafter where they capture this boy, he doesn't have a name at this point. He's just a little Aboriginal boy. And there's a fight scene where they are very rough and very ready with him. You know, they're taking him in. They're catching him like he's a wild animal. And that's how they treat him. You know, they throw him into a burlap sack and throw him over a horse to get to this Christian orphanage.
Yeah.
And you know, he's treated roughly from the very get-go by these men. So when he gets to the orphanage, my heart sank straight away because it's the 1940s, things were very difficult then. It's a very hard time.
Yeah.
And
you've got
that sentence running through your head of, you know, breed out the black and how, you know, the very negative attitude they had towards Aboriginal and Indigenous people, full stop. So when he gets to the orphanage, it's the first thing that throws.
Well, let's hear the clip. This is the moment where he arrives at the orphanage.
Yeah.
So he's been brought here by a
rough and ready policeman,
who's kind of basically thrown him in the door in a sack.
Yeah.
And immediately it's Cate Blanchett who opens the door and she immediately lets him out of the sack. Let's hear what happens.
Don Peter here?
No, he's asleep. But he asked me to wait.
I got a special delivery for him. It's a little darky.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. He's a bolter. Oh,
Jesus. Oh. Hey! Get out of there, little bugger. Come out of there. Come
on. Is that what we're doing? Hey?
What are you doing, sister?
Is it? Come on.
What are you
doing? Come on, I dare you.
Take the paperwork, will you? Oh, Jesus.
What's his name?
He hasn't got one.
And there we go, Cate Blanchett. She kind of puts her
fist
up.
She was throwing down. She was going to give him a hammering.
She was ready to
leave the boy alone.
And my heart lifted for a moment because, again, Donald, this is not what I expected. Because here was And as we see, both Sister Eileen, as, which is the character played by Cate Blanchett, and Sister Mum, who is the other nun in the orphanage looking after these young boys who are brought in, they're actually quite kind to them and quite
It's caring. Interesting, isn't it? And we have had quite a few films, stories and films about kids and adults a few times in the care of the Catholic Church in this country over the last few years, and with very few exceptions, supposed carers don't come out very well from them. So I suppose one of the biggest inadvertent challenges for an Irish audience here is the thwarted expectation that Cate Blanchett, who is, as you say, the head nun, is going to turn out to be a monster. Not least because Cate Blanchett is pretty good at monsters, so when you hear that she's cast in this role, you kind of think that's where it's going. And it's not that way at all. I mean, there's a discussion going on about in the film about the Catholic Church's attitude towards where the new boy comes from. That there's clearly no attempt made to negotiate with his spiritual beliefs and his background when inculcating Catholicism into him. But that's not too firm a way of putting it.
Yeah, because we see pretty early on, we see the baptism of one of the young boys who has been in the orphanage for a period of time, and that's why where they all get their names, John, James, Mark, that it's all biblical names and all Christian names that they're being given.
But it's worth pointing out again that we don't know how closely this is based on Warwick Thornton's own
this
upbringing.
This is the writer-director,
yes, in such an institution. But he dares, if terror is the word, gives a largely benevolent Roman Catholic care home, which I can only guess is partly from his own experience, because it's a hard thing to sell when we've all been told over and over again that these people are unremitting monsters.
Yeah, and we do hear about that Dom Peter character who's mentioned, who we kind of find out a little bit about later on in a great scene where Blanchett pretends to be him, basically fighting with herself in behind a closed door.
And using some choice language.
Yeah, but there's another character, George. Is it Wayne Blair who plays the character of George, who's kind of one of the farmhands?
He's the farmhand. He's in charge of the farm and the sheep and the crop. And he says
to the new boy at one stage, "I'm on a good wicket here, boy. Don't you go messing it up for me." Yeah. And I thought, all right, here's where the awfulness is going to start to appear. But that doesn't transpire either. So what is the story that we get in this? And there's a bit of magic realism.
Yeah, like I think I said in my notes, you know, if you sort of an Aboriginal Green Mile, you wouldn't be too far away from the general gist of this.
Yeah, he is some kind of special power.
And George does say at one point to the nuns, you know, like he's the little medicine man. That's what he calls him, the little medicine man.
Yeah, because a kid gets a snake bite and he manages to cure. But you think, well, he might be well capable of doing that, because if he's been living in the bush, he would know where to get rid of a snake bite.
He understands things about the bush that the boys don't really understand. Yeah. He understands what snakes are poisonous, what snakes are not. He understands how to catch, you know, because when he wants to help out with Sister Mum and, you know, preparing this feast for the boys for Easter and for the harvest, you know, he goes off and kills like loads of little chameleons and stuff, and also two lambs that he shouldn't have killed, you know. And
that's Roman actually turns up with the lambs and they frown at him, and then the next shot is them tucking into roast lambs.
It's that sort of, there's a huge innocence about him, and he's thrust into something that he's not familiar with. And they don't really try to understand him
because that's my point.
That's the thing about it. They don't really try to understand him because for them, goodness radiates from Catholicism and from church.
And he is trying to understand them. There's a wooden crucifix brought along, and the figure of Jesus is put up on the cross, and it becomes a crucifix then. Mm. And he's trying to understand the Christian religion and try to ingratiate himself.
And he's also horrified. You can see he's horrified. He's actually, the little actor who plays him is very good. He transmits a lot from his eyes.
Because he says
really
about
speak.
Three words. Yeah, he says amen and one other word, I think, at some point.
And he's horrified by the crucifixion. He's horrified when he sees the crown of thorns go on Christ. Yeah. He's horrified when he sees the nails driven into the palm
the wooden
of his
hands.
And he can't, you can see that he just can't understand how this, as Blanchett, as a character says at one point, you know, he's sacred, but he just can't seem to, it seems to be a terrible way to treat someone who is sacred.
There are phenomenal performances here, certainly from the young boy, Osmond Reed, who has a couple of words to say.
He does.
He just holds the screen.
Yeah, I mean, and he struggles with some of the material, which I don't think comes off quite so well, which is, as Arlene says, the magic magic realist stuff. I mean, yeah. I didn't buy the kind of Tinkerbell floating around him. And
yeah, he's the kind of magic. I thought it was a firefly, but no.
It feels like something there has been cut out. Maybe it hasn't. But it feels like that's something that's been not fully developed. But I would also think we can't, I think, talk about this film without talking about the depiction of the land. I mean, Australian cinema, I mean, all Australian art perhaps, is kind of aware that the bit of Australia that thinks itself modern society is like a few barnacles stuck to this the helm of this vast ship, which is for the most part empty. And the continent, in this film is just cast, I think, beautifully as this entirely ochre, almost Mark Rothko background.
Yeah, beautiful wheat fields all around the place. Does the film ultimately work? I mean, because I found myself watching it and kind of being sucked in, but at the end of it saying, what did it get?
Yeah,
did
I found, at the end I, of that? I was in a bit of a struggle with it all the way through, largely because I think both the characterization and also this odd spiritual element to it never resolved themselves properly. I couldn't get a full grasp of the Cate Blanchett character the new boy.
I found it slowed down to a glacial pace after a very good opening, I thought, as well. And it's quite repetitive in places. But what really, and it sounds baffling to say it because they're good, the nuns are good people, but that is the weakness about it, because there's no contrast then between, you know, how this young boy who has his own beliefs and his own mystical being, and now he's going to be brought into the church no matter what he likes.
Yeah,
he's going
I
to
think
be baptized.
There possibly is some metaphor for the kind of the loss of the Aboriginal power by the
presence exactly
of the,
and so, but because they're such kind people, it's very hard to find the contrast there for them.
Does it work overall at stars?
I liked it. I'm going to give it 2.5 out of 5. I liked it, but I think it just lost a lot of itself towards
all
the
right.
end.
All right, and Donald?
I would give it 3 again. I found it fighting all the way to resolve these various things which seemed left untied.
All right, let's finish up then with Monster, Japanese film. Hirokazu Koreeda returns with Monster. It really is hard to work out who the monster is in this film. The plot line here is a young boy being bullied.
It's hard to work out. To summarise the plot, it's enormously complicated. But it starts off with the suspicion that a boy is being bullied, possibly by the teacher. Then that development transpires. That's not quite true. Meanwhile, there's a mystery going on about the burning down of a dance hall.
Hostess bar.
I'm trying to say. In the town, all these things are clattering around in a story that has a certain amount of that Rashomon thing, a certain amount of that going back to the beginning and telling from a different perspective. So it's really impossible. But let's just say it's principally about the relationship between two boys in this Japanese town. It's a fascinating piece of work in that I've loved all of Koreeda's films. I haven't encountered one yet that I haven't liked, including this one. But up until this point, they tend to have a very simple story. Shoplifters is probably the best known, which won the Palme d'Or in 2018, I think. And he's been making these very humanistic, simple stories that nonetheless have incredible resonance for years. And this is the first film that he's made that's not from his own screenplay in over 20 years, and you can tell it still, I think, works very well, but it is a very different kind of film to what he usually makes.
And for all of that, I mean, there is a complicated plot and we see it from loads of different perspectives, but what struck me most particularly with the two boys was this kind of non-acting, and I mean that very positively. It's just like the camera was watching them playing in the wherever they were playing.
It was a secret camera. They weren't aware they were on camera.
Yeah.
It was astounding how their relationship was allowed flourish like that. I wondered how he directed them. It was one of those things, you know, when you're watching something, you're thinking, how did you direct them for this? Did he just leave them or say, I'm going to turn this camera off for a while. You just do what you're going to do while I figure something out, you know, because it was so natural. Yeah. But I thought the mother, Sari, she was really natural the way she moved all
and
the way through it, and
the
teachers
school.
Were, and, you know, the principal, even though the principal's a complicated woman of her own, you know, like, the Japanese culture is astounding to watch as well. You know, the sort of the respect shown and given and shown and taken and shown.
And where if you do something wrong with the child, you apologise to the child, to the child's parents, you apologise to your fellow
and
staff members.
And to your staff members, because you let everyone down.
Shaming the school. Yeah. Very interesting in that regard.
Really, really interesting.
And a
fascinating.
Good 2-hour watch, but you just need to watch and don't be looking for some big tie-up at the end.
And watch it quietly, because it's very, if you get distracted in this movie, you're going to miss a lot.
Yeah, because every moment.
And we just also mentioned, I think it's the last work we're going to hear from Ryuichi Sakamoto, the great Japanese.
Oh, yes, the composer,
A composer and electronica master. So it's a lovely score from him. And ends up being a great tribute to him, who died last year.
Stars?
Four.
Solid four?
Three.
Three from you. That is Donald Clark. Arlene Hunt, Drive Away Dolls, goes on general release tomorrow, Friday, while The New Boy and Monster open in selected cinemas also tomorrow. Just on the basis of our film reviews that you just heard, are they worth following? Well, Sean says this text, went to see Origin today based on the five star recommendations of you and your critics. Thank you. One of the best films we've seen in years. Please tell your audience that there are only a few showings left over the next week. AQ, the initials on that text. Yeah, Origin was a great movie and it is well worth seeing. You will think a lot about it afterwards. Now, the National Concert Hall in Dublin will host a special St. Patrick's Day concert featuring the music of Irish composer Sean Davey, performed by the National Symphony Orchestra. The concert will be conducted by David Brophy, a lineup of renowned soloists, including Rita Conley, of course. The celebration of Sean Davey's work will feature the world premiere of St. Patrick's Overture, commissioned by the National Symphony Orchestra. Additionally, the programme includes Davey's Grand Noël and the Brendan Voyage pieces that have contributed significantly to contemporary Irish music in recent times. And delighted that Sean Davey is with me in studio this evening. When you hear it's a St. Patrick's Day overture for St. Patrick's Day, you think, why didn't we think of that before?
Do you think it's a bit corny? Maybe. I suggested that I might try one St. Patrick's Day overture a few years back, and it didn't go down too well. But I raised it again last year, and at the NSO. Said yes. What's more, they said yes to including the concert hall organ in the piece. So that's been a real adventure.
Yeah, because there are two aspects, I suppose, to that organ be played. First of all, the organ is there in the National Concert Hall, begging to be used, you know, and possibly doesn't get as much use as one might like.
Begging to be maintained as well.
Yeah, right? Well, there's that aspect to it. Yeah.
Well, I was very keen to write for it for various reasons, because if there is an enlargement of the concert hall, I hope that the organ is retained because it's a huge, it's a unique thing in the country.
Just to have, it there. And you had spent some time, was it last year in Paris on a residency where you went around some of the organs of that city?
Well, yeah, in Paris, every Sunday, there are free concerts in the big churches. Mm. And they have these monster organs and they have fantastic musicians to play them. Free, you can walk in every Sunday afternoon, which I did. And I was a resident at the Cultural Centre. For a month, and I had Paris for a month.
What? Where was the church that you went in yourself and improvised on one of these?
Well, the Cultural Centre has a chapel.
All right.
And they have a resident priest as well. And I was pressed to actually play a couple of improvisations one day, which I did. But they have this old antique pedal harmonium. It's a gorgeous old French instrument, and I took an interest in that. And it was great for them to have me over because I had a great time. It was very formative. It was very helpful to think about this particular piece.
And we'll come back to the organ and what it lends to the piece.
I also learned to ride a bicycle in Paris.
Had you not ridden a bicycle before?
I knew how to ride a bicycle.
Oh, sorry.
It was an electric bicycle. I got into riding through the Parisian traffic in
So it was the specifics of how to ride the bicycle in Paris rather than that you happened to learn it there.
Yes, almost as important as hearing all the organs play.
You travelled from organ to organ on an electric bicycle.
I literally did, actually, one day. Yeah.
At any rate, you say that this idea around St. Patrick had been in your mind for some time.
Well,
what was it about his character?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm not religious, but... what interested me was, firstly, because this was the third year in a third year running, performing with the NSO in the concert hall, and I wanted to make it special, if I could. That's the first thing. The second thing, obviously, like everybody else, I follow the news. I hate what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Gaza, and what's happening in America, and I just think somehow we're going to end up in the middle of a catastrophe. And it sort of brings to mind that there is a constant struggle between good and evil going on, and it's very current and it's very present in our lives. And I was then thinking, well, St. Patrick, basically, he's our patron saint because he banished evil from Ireland. The snakes are just a metaphor. Mm. So the piece of music that I've tried to write is about this miraculous banishment of evil from the world. Hence the big organ with a big orchestra. It had to have this sense of power, also a sense of horror, because I found it really hard to write music that is has a sense of horror in it. I hadn't done it before, certainly not successfully. I may have pulled it off this time, but I felt very driven to try and capture that sense of this something terrible having to be confronted.
Let me start with something that, even though it is, I'm presuming the cor anglais is the snake in the midst of all of this.
But of course.
The snake does have a lovely, slithery, slippery melody as well as everything else, doesn't it?
And this is a sleepy snake, you know. This is a snake you think isn't going to harm you. And then there's a snake behind that one.
All right, yeah. So beware the vanguard is one thing, but watch for the rear guard as well. Yeah. Let's listen to then the cor anglais kind of weaving its way around, and this then moves into a great.
Then you hear the organ.
Yeah, we hear the organ at the end, which I think gives us a sense of the size as the piece grows. So a section there from St. Patrick's Overture, a work that will receive its world premiere from the National Symphony Orchestra on St. Patrick's Night, new composition from Sean Davey, who's with me in studio this evening. I'm saying as we were listening to that, you mentioned this idea of the horror that the organ brings in when it comes in there after that lovely, slithery, slippery snake on the cor anglais. Mm. But it struck me, and we said this as we were listening, that kind of cacophonous, discordant sound is not normally something that is part of your musical palette. Well, not something that we've experienced too often.
No. I feel I'm exploring new ground for me, which is, I think, is very healthy. And it's the direction I would like to travel at the moment. It's more discordant, but it's also freer. I think it's more expressive. And really what I've always tried to do is to create, I've always tried to paint images, but these are a different kind of images. These are more, you know, challenging images.
Yeah, well, it speaks to the
kind of... And I'm trying to get them into an audience's mind and let their imagination do it. Mm. I mean, in a way, it's sort of music without a film, but it's all about images and a story.
Yeah, and it does speak to the kind of anxieties that you're expressing, or the hatred of what's happening in various parts of the world.
Absolutely,
at the moment, and this sense that you have of, you know, we're kind of freewheeling.
Something that needs to be resisted, you know. in whatever ways we can.
Mm, yeah, and I suppose even making us hear it kind of makes you sit up and think a little bit more about it. I do want to play another little section from a different part of the overture as well, because this is St. Patrick at Sea, which is a much more more pleasant thing. But I think this links into your house move. When was the house move? Years back now, is it?
We moved from Wicklow to very close to the shore of the River Boyne. We're very close to the mouth of Yestre, and there's a lovely, beautiful beach nearby. And I discovered, somebody told me that it's where St. Patrick is reputed to have landed when he came back to Ireland the second time. And so it had all sorts of echoes, and that, of course, played into the, you know, the thinking. So the piece you're going to play is, actually, it's the start of the whole piece, and it's a salty theme, and I'm trying to get the effect of, you'll know about the Bronze Age Irish instrument called the dord, which was a long horn. It was a sort of brass long horn. And I was trying to evoke the sense of St. Patrick coming to that Bronze Age settlement up the River Boyne with the long horns playing.
Yeah, we hear the horns in the midst of all this, but there is really that, as you say, that salty seafaring type of sense to it as well. As I'm listening to that little section of Patrick at Sea, there is the sense almost of the drummer beating the drum for the rowers or whatever.
Keeping in time with the rowers.
To keep the ship at sea. A couple of things that I want to mention before we finish up, Sean, and I do want to play a little bit of the end of the overture as well. This is potentially Rita Connolly's last performance.
Well, we don't know. Rita's is a perfectionist. She wants to sing only at her best, which she still can. But, you know, she first sang Gráinne Bhfuil when she was 27. It's 10 very demanding songs with an orchestra. We may not do Gráinne Bhfuil next year, and if not, then the year after that she will be 67. So we just don't know. How long can you do it?
Can the voice
But
do
she's
that?
Very adamant that she doesn't want to sing below her power. And I think on Sunday she will be singing perfectly,
Anne-Marie, I spoke with Anne-Marie recently, the great mezzo-soprano who spoke about knowing that moment to say, quit while the voice is still there. Don't wait for it to tell you have to stop.
Yeah.
But I suppose that let Rita make that decision.
It's in her mind, and she will make that decision. So
the other thing, as I go into this, I mean, several other pals are there, not least of whom is Noel Eccles on percussion, which we really hear in this final section of the piece itself.
Noel Eccles is there, and Noel Eccles played on the first recording of the Brendan Voyage. That's 1980, and we've been staunch allies ever since. But also, principal percussionist Richard O'Donnell, I've worked with for nearly as long.
This orchestra really well.
I know a lot of them. Some of them are gone, but I mean, I know Katrina is a wonderful flute player. I know Matthew's a wonderful oboe player. I know Martin Johnson is a fantastic cellist. So I've written for everybody that I'm familiar with, you know.
Yeah, so it has that. And am I right in thinking that the percussion gets quite a bit of work in this final section?
Well, everybody gets a lot of work because this is a very loud piece. Yes, the percussion do get a lot, but so do the brass. It's a big blow for them.
Yeah, well, we'll listen to a little bit of that final section.
Thank you very much.
Exodus of the Snakes, which is, I guess, what you're hoping for in metaphorical terms in the world as well, Sean.
We can but hope.
Well, if we don't hope, we won't get much else besides, will we? This is the National Symphony Orchestra. I should say, very kind of you to give us those recordings from rehearsals, and very kind of the orchestra to share them with us as well. Patrick, Exodus of the Snakes, the National Symphony Orchestra. There we go. It is big stuff indeed, isn't it? That is Exodus of the Snakes from Sean Davies, St. Patrick's Overture. And that work will get its world premiere on St. Patrick's Night in the National Concert Hall with the National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy. Of course, Gran You will be performed with Rita Connolly doing the singing there. And Brendan Voyage will be there too, with Mark Power, isn't it, who's playing the pipes on the night. Should be a great evening indeed. 7:30 p.m. at the National Concert Hall, nch.ie, for full details. And before I go a single step further, Mark Redmond is playing the Hillen Pipes at that concert on St. Patrick's Night. Mark Redmond's at home. Who's this Mark other person that he's talking about? Mark Redmond on the Hillen Pipes for the Brendan Voyage. And Rita Connolly will be there. Mark Redmond, Peter Connolly, Davey, Rita and Sean's son. Noel Eccles on percussion. Trina Marshall on harp. Fergal Caulfield will be at the organ and piano. And Ewan Curley will be part of the evening as well. nch.ie for full details there. Now, 10 years after his death, the son of the Colombian Nobel laureate, Gabriel García Márquez, the sons have published Until August, a so-called lost novel by the master of magic realism. The book tells the story of one Anna Magdalena Bach, a woman who travels to an island every summer to visit her mother's grave. The publication is controversial. The book was written while the author was ill with dementia, and he told his family before his death that Until August was to be destroyed. John Self has been reading it for us, and he joins me on the line right now. Already I'm annoyed, John. You know, don't publish this book, please. The two sons write a preface to the edition that I have. What is their reasoning behind the publishing of the book?
Well, what is their stated reason is because they think it is actually full of many wonderful things that they didn't think were in it 10 years ago when they first read it, whenever he recognised it despite his ailing condition, you know, that it wasn't that good. But, you know, and look, maybe he's their father, they admire, maybe they're innocently overrating the book. I'm sure money couldn't have been further from their minds. They do say that one of the reasons is to actually protect their copyright in case someone else should publish it after their death. So, you know, there's a certain amount of admitted cynicism there too, I think.
Yeah, and they do. I think they in fact use the word it was a betrayal. They use that themselves within the preface to the book. So let's acknowledge that they do that. Of course, they did it before with the film 100 or the Netflix version of 100 Years of Solitude, didn't they?
They did, because Marquez had always said that he didn't. He'd always resisted and rebuffed any attempts to buy the film rights to that novel. They say that was actually for practical purposes, because it couldn't be fitted into a film length, but a TV series would be okay, or it had to be done in Spanish. You know, well, that's what they say. They would say that, but yeah, it's certainly not the first "quote unquote" betrayal that they've done to his legacy.
All right, what story? Because there's an argument as to whether this novel is, well, I don't think there's any argument as to whether it's finished or not. I mean, Marquez himself said, "Please don't publish this." And maybe he would have come back to it had his powers still been at the full of their height, or at the height of, if he still had been at the height of his powers. What story is he telling?
Well, he's telling the story of a woman who, as you say in the intro, Anna Magdalena Bach, who, for reasons unknown to us and not explained in the book, has the same name as Johann Sebastian Bach's wife. She's a 46-year-old woman. At the start of the book, she's 46, and she's a happily married woman in, we presume, Colombia or a similar country. And every year on the 16th of August, she travels to this adjacent island to visit her mother's grave and pay tribute to her mother. So she's presented as this very sort of straight and respectable lady, which makes what she then does when she goes to the island every year all the more surprising.
What does she do, John?
Well, funny you should ask me that. She goes there, and the first night that she's there, that's in the book, she essentially has a fling or a one-night stand with a man in the inn where she's staying, and she regrets it and feels guilty about it when she goes back to her husband. But then she does it again the next year and the year after that, and so it becomes perhaps not quite so uncharacteristic after all. And there is an awful lot, I have to say, of what, you know, we can only describe as bad sex writing in the book, which I won't quote the worst bits of, but there's a lot of, you know, raising her to her boiling point and things like that, and much much worse. And you know,
and you're not paraphrasing. You're not paraphrasing when you say.
I'm not paraphrasing. That is a quote. That is a quote for removing her clothes with magical mastery. You know, it's all a bit, you know, cringe, as my kids would say. And if I hadn't been holding the book in my hands, I probably would have been reading it through gaps in my fingers by that stage. Very much the, you know, the male gaze at work. When she's not doing that, she's admiring her own body in the mirror and things like that. It's all a bit off.
Yeah, and I wondered then. I mean, have you any sense of this link? Because when I saw Anna Magdalena Bach, I thought, right, we're going to get some link back to the music. The music of Bach is going to feature here in some way. There's going to be some connection back to her, you know. But no.
No. I mean, and this is one of the things, you know, Marquez, you know, if he had been at the height of his powers, maybe there was something there that was going to be brought into it. There's an awful lot of that in the book, you know, where there's a little maybe reference to something and a little thing that you think, oh, that's quite nice. You know, the old Marquez would have made something of that. You know, there's a nice line about she's in the harbour and she sees all these fishermen who have got mutilated arms because of the premature explosion of their dynamite sticks and stuff. And, you know, you think Marquez, he would have got a chapter out of that, you know, in one of his earlier novels, or at least a few pages. And it's just there and it's gone. So almost in some ways the book feels almost like an outline, you know, of something that was never really fully fleshed out.
And do you have a sense of that then, even as it, you know, is there an arc within whatever draft of the book or whatever version of the book that this is? Is there an arc of a story, or do you feel that it kind of ends in midair?
Well, it does have an ending, curiously enough, but it does, you know, it goes through these four consecutive years where she has these flings and then she goes back to her husband, and then that sort of, in an equally sort of cringe way, rekindles their love life. But in the end, there is an ending, which I won't spoil for anyone who does want to read the book, but it sort of comes in very suddenly, and it comes in, you know, almost as if we're not really given much clarity as to how the book was finally put together, the version that we see. So we don't really know, is that something that Marquez actually put at that point in the book, or was it maybe, you know, brought in by someone else? It's all a little bit mysterious.
Unfortunately not in the English language version that we have, and it's a regular translator of Marquez's work that has given us this, I think, as well, isn't it? But at the end of the Spanish edition of the book, there's a lengthy editor's note. We don't get that in the English language version.
Well, I have a version of that, actually, Sean, so I have read that, and it's not really, it seems to me to obscure more than it illuminates. You know, it talks rather vaguely about when the book was written. Was it the late 90s? Was it the early 2000s? Was it finished? Was it not? Why did he had to be encouraged to go back to it around 2010? You know, it talks in sort of rather vague terms about how his memory didn't enable him to complete it. When, as you said at the outset, you know, the man had dementia, the man was failing, was declining, and, you know, he's far beyond finishing a book at this point. I have read that afterward by editor, and to my mind, it obscures more than it illuminates.
I have to say that the part of the preface that I found potentially most disturbing was where the son's tried to put forward this argument that perhaps it was their father's dementia that meant he didn't see how good the book was. I thought that was very cynical.
That is deeply cynical, as I say, and you know, I'm sure they were very well paid for this last work of fiction ever, and no doubt by a great Nobel Prize winning writer. But you know, and you can pretend all those things, but you can't pretend that it's going to add to his legacy or add to his standing.
Yeah, is it a scholar? Would it be of interest and of some benefit as a scholarly work? You know, somebody who could actually start to parse this particular novel in whatever state it is, and give scholarly a scholarly interpretation of what it tells us about the Marquez that we all know and love, or that many people know and love.
I mean, it's possible. I'm not a Marquez scholar myself, but you know, it seems to me to be. And there's, you know, late work generally is interesting because it tells us, you know, it gives us an example of how writers continue to work through the themes that they've obsessed with through their life. I don't really think it's up to that standard because it's so slight. But you know, a completist, I'm sure, would be interested in it, and scholars may get something from it. Who knows?
Were there any moments along the way where you got flashes of the man who gave us Love in the Time of Cholera and 100 Years of Solitude?
Well, there is occasionally. I mentioned the thing about the fishermen, or after her first fling, the first lover she takes, she finds when he's gone the next day that he's left a $20 bill in the book beside the bed, and she wonders if this is payment for services, which is a nice, funny little detail, you know. But by and large, it's all a little bit too fragmented, and you know, the best thing you can say about it, I suppose, is that it's it, 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 even if you don't like it, it won't take long to find out because it's pretty short.
Yeah, it says, what is it, about 120 pages or somewhere in that
area? Yeah, of large print, yeah.
So should it have remained a lost novel, and should his wishes have been followed in the regard of saying, please don't publish this book?
I'm afraid I think it probably should have. You know, there's just not. Put it this way: if it hadn't been published, we might all have still thought it was good.
Yeah, and he might have. I suppose his reputation would be absolutely and fully intact. Are we in the same place as Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman here, or are we in a different spot?
We're in a slightly different spot because she was still alive whenever that was published, and although there was obviously a cloud over whether or not she really approved that properly because she was very old, blind, deaf, and, you know, 6 months from death herself, but that was an early work. That was an apprentice work of an early form, if you like, of To Kill a Mockingbird, whereas this is clearly something, a very slight thing by a man whose powers have left him. So I think the Harper Lee one is probably of more interest in the scholarly way that you mentioned than this book is.
I think perhaps we should say to people that if they decide to read Until August, they have to choose to read another great Marquez novel to cleanse their palate. Where would you send them?
Well, the big two are Love in the Time of Cholera and 100 Years of Solitude. They're quite chunky, so there are also some shorter ones that are also very nice, like Of Love and Other Demons or Chronicle of a Death Foretold. So any one of those, you've got four
to choose from there. Don't be rushing out for Until August, if I'm not putting words into your mouth, John. But is that what you're saying?
It is indeed, so.
That's John Self speaking to us about Until August by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, published by Penguin. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Lyles Fitzmaurice was the researcher. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator tonight. And Aisling Grufferty was in sound. Tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.